You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Parish Council. It's the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw, and I believe what the old man said, but I know that there's no Lord above. I believe in me, and I believe in you, and you know I believe in love. I believe in truth, though I lie a lot. I feel the pain from the push and shove. No matter what you put me through, I'll still believe in love, and I say, it's Terence Stackham.
Oh, hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello.
My God, you did well there. Oh, yes. In one part.
So I've been rehearsing that all week.
I'll tell you what, Magnus Shaw, here's the thing. Earlier this week, I was meeting someone in Kilburn in North London.
Oh, yes.
And so I emerged from the tube network into Kilburn Park Tube Station. And I entered this world of classical Baroque music, the most unlikely thing, in the ticket hall of Kilburn Park Tube Station. Handel's Water Music, I think it was, played at a hefty volume.
Right.
So I remarked on the pleasantness of this to the sort of London underground bloke that was sort of loitering in the ticket hall. And he explained to me that it was a measure to keep kids away, to stop them hanging around the tube station.
Really?
And, you know, yeah, absolutely. They pump out, always it seems, this sort of, because when I went back later, that was still from the Baroque period, really quite a loud volume, sort of Motorhead volume. And it's all designed, and it clearly works, because there were no youngsters hanging around. There's a big school just round the corner, and this chap was saying to me that they got so fed up of children mucking about, and, you know, it's quite sort of dangerous, really, sort of rushing around in the ticket hall and everything, that they derived this theory that if they pumped out classical music at a large volume, it would keep the children away. And this made me feel really rather sad, because to think that young people in Kilburn are learning that George Friedrich Handel and Scarlatti, Vivaldi, Monteverdi are weapons to keep young people at bay.
Yeah.
And so here's a generation who will probably never hear the great tonality of the Baroque period, because they'll forever link the beauty of Gabrielli and Telemann to the day they were hustled out of a tube station. So I was going to ask you, do they play Purcell and Pachelbel in Derbyshire railway stations to keep you away?
No. Unfortunately, I can't be kept away from train stations, because I have to use the flipping trains quite a lot. I wouldn't take much persuading to keep away from a train station, but they don't play any music in my local train station at all. But then again, kids don't hang around in the train station, because the train stations aren't on high streets, are they, in the same way that the tube stations are. But I was walking through my local town last night in the freezing drizzle, and I did notice this phenomenon of the sort of groups of teens hanging around. And there seemed to be, I mean, it was freezing cold, it was damp and horrible, and there seemed to be little attraction in doing that, and it just occurred to me that they were doing that because for want of anywhere else to congregate. And I think we get rather too uptight about young people getting together. It's what young people do and what they want to do, and there's no reason we can't capitalise on that and get them together in a constructive way. But the poor souls hanging around sharing a bottle of WKD and some cheap ciggies in the pouring drizzle just struck me as being very sad for them, really. I didn't envy them in the slightest.
It is a sad phenomenon, and I think this is common in many town centres and village centres throughout the land. And I think there is a difference between, it's easy to sort of lump this all into one heading where there is a really terrible problem with town centres in particular, certainly down here in the south, late at night, and particularly on Fridays and Saturdays, anything after 10:30, most towns are no-go areas because of the behaviour of older young people who are, you know, just causing chaos through having had a lot to drink.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to say these.
But that's not this. That's what you're talking, I think, about younger people with nowhere to go.
Yeah, absolutely. They weren't threatening at all. They weren't even particularly noisy. They were just there. A couple of them were for my money, too young to be out after dark. But there you go. But it was just the notion that they all wanted to be together and doing stuff, but there was nothing to do. And I just thought that was a real shame. The thing you say about the classical music as a deterrent reminds me of a product that I read about, maybe a couple of years ago, called the Mosquito. Do you know about the Mosquito?
Oh, you'll have to remind me. It rings a bell.
Well, it's bizarre. It's quite Orwellian, really. But and I never knew this before I heard about this product, but there is a frequency range in the audio spectrum that you can only hear up to about the age of 17, and then you lose that ability. And so they created a device that's emitted a sound at this frequency, which is, you know, quite high, so it's rather unpleasant if it's high volume and high pitch, and sort of attached it to bus shelters and subway stations or whatever. And of course, adults could come and go as they pleased because they couldn't hear it, but young people wouldn't hang about because they would be plagued by this high pitch screeching, hence the name the Mosquito. And that seems like a similar sort of thing. At least, I suppose, with the Mosquito, it wouldn't spoil the pleasures of classical music for them, but I don't.
No, I suppose not. I thought of a couple of examples, a bit like your Mosquito, but also more like the Handel's water music in the foyer of Kilburn Park Tube Station, where this could be used in a more positive way. Okay, so I thought if cake shops played thrash metal, that would ensure that I maintained a safe distance and would be much better for my health.
Absolutely, yes.
I would bypass them instead of going in and think, Belgian bun. Yeah. But if I heard, you know, that sort of thrash metal coming out of the speakers, I wouldn't go in.
Yeah, it might shatter their business model. It's a very refined French patisserie in Covent Garden with the doors flung open and playing Slayer at top volume.
It'd be good for the nation's health. But maybe this one will work better. I was thinking the police should insist that crack dens play John Denver and Barry Manilow, and then drug use would drop immediately. It would keep all the hip dudes away.
Interested to see that enforced as the drug squad crashing through the doors of some squat, not to take the recidivists away or indeed seize the drugs, but just castigate them for not playing easy listening music.
It would take a level of cooperation between the crack den business owners and the police, it must be said. You can imagine just going in there for a hit that her name was Lola. She was...
You make a huge assumption that users of hard drugs don't enjoy John Denver and Barry Manilow. So there's a...
It is, but I think it may be a fairly safe assumption.
Do you think so? Okay.
So not a good week for young people wanting to hang around in Kilburn Park Tube Station. Also not the best week for tiny pop star Justin Bieber.
No, good grief, no.
His week began with a teenage strop, which I absolutely, this was absolutely delicious, when his entourage were denied access to some nightclub in Soho. And he tweeted a very teenage message. he tweeted, worst birthday ever. and of course it's ended, sort of breaking news on today, Friday, with poor Justin having been taken to hospital after he fainted on stage last night. He was treated by emergency services, but being the brave dude that is, he came back and finished the concert.
Against medical advice.
But of course, earlier this week, he was booed by his fans after leaving them waiting for a couple of hours before blaming the delay at the O2 concert on, inverted commas, technical issues. And of course, his week got a bit weirder even after that, because the paparazzi have been taking photos of him going around London. He's been wearing a gas mask and he's been going around London, and the paps have been taking photos of him. Anyway, but particularly interesting on this being late on stage at the O2 business, because Noel Gallagher was one of the parents who was involved. His 13-year-old daughter, Anaïs, was at the gig when Bieber turned up late. And Noel Gallagher was quoted in the paper saying this week, my daughter likes him, and if I'd been a parent at that gig with kids crying, I'd have been really disappointed. It's not cool. And weighing in also, Kelly Jones of the Stereophonics and some bloke called Tom Magan from Kasabian. And this Kasabian bloke said, well, wait for this, Bieber should be publicly flogged. Being 2 hours late is rude. Mm. And Kelly Jones from the Stereophonics said, if you can't get on stage on time, you deserve a slap. So, Magnus, are you a believer?
No, not in the slightest. You know, still to this day, I couldn't name, much less hum you, a Justin Bieber song. He's a new breed of pop star, I think, that just sort of exists in his own persona. Of course, all his many, many fans know all his songs, but outside that coterie of youngsters, we don't know his music, do we? I mean, we tend to, you know, any band that gets big, or act that gets big, even if we really don't like them, they're not up our street at all, because they're so big, we know their songs. But there is this generation of sort of One Directions and Biebers who we don't know their songs. The songs are immaterial. They're the second place to the actual, you know, bubble of celebrity that these people are contained in. So I'm not a believer, but I suppose people would say, but if you don't know his songs, how do you know? Well, I don't really. I think he's absolutely fantastic. He certainly made my week, that's for sure, because I just think these stories have been absolutely hilarious. And as you say, it really smacks of a prepubescent boy being dragged around the world and not really enjoying it and making a dreadful hash of it, you know, it's in the most hilarious way, I think. But that's vaguely serious note. Yes, if you take your children to a show, and I would imagine, you know, because it was a weekday show, there was a lot of persuading going on. You know, there's a lot of kids saying, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please. And the parents have, you know, caved and said, okay, but as it ends at 10 o'clock, you must be in bed by 11, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then to go through it and find the NERC doesn't come on till 10:29, you're going to be fuming. And there were many parents who had to leave before he came on, left after the first number because they had public transport to catch. I'd be interested to know whether they're going to get their money back personally.
Well, I've got a kind of first-hand report on this because friends of mine took their 13-year-old daughter and her friend, and they were planning to wait in one of those food outlets just outside the O2. You know what I mean? That kind of surround outside. Plenty of place there, and they figured, well, once all the youngsters gone in, we'll be able to have, you know, let their daughter in, and they'll be able to have a sort of nice dinner in one of these places, you know, while she's bopping inside. But they were saying, thank goodness for the age of mobile phones, because they were able to keep in touch with their daughter. By the way, although they said the signal was intermittent, was their words, at the O2 arena. Of all places, yeah. You know, but I suppose perhaps because so many people were trying to use the network to keep in touch, they were able to sort of keep in touch with her because the daughter was getting panicky, not because, you know, they were worried about being inside, but worried about what the parents were thinking outside because they were, you know, it was getting so late. But anyway, my friend's daughter later emerged I think neither of us would be surprised by this. The familiar tale, lack of communication. Yeah. You know, nobody's telling the audience what was going on or what was happening. She reported on tired younger children actually falling asleep in their seats as the night wore on. And I don't know whether this was to help or to hinder, but there was this, what they did was they just played an endless loop of Michael Jackson hits.
Yes.
While they were waiting. Did you hear about that?
Yeah,
while they were waiting
for
the 2 hours. Yeah. It was just an endless loop of Michael Jackson. And then all these sort of, because many of Bieber's fans are actually below that sort of 13-year age. They're sort of 9, 10-year olds. And as she was saying, many were curled up asleep in their seats. But also, I don't know if you heard it, there was, it was sort of like breaking news on radio stations late on that evening. And your mate Tony Livesey on 5 Live BBC Radio was receiving calls from people on the spot as well. And there was one parent, Wayne Parsonage, he said he paid £400 for 3 tickets, and he ended up missing the performance so that he could make the last train home, like you said a minute ago.
I would be putting in some strongly worded letters to the venue and or the promoter there. It's just a part of a wider world of dreadfully poor customer service, and I don't know why anybody cannot address this lack of information thing. You know, if your flight's delayed, if your train is cancelled, if you never get the information, and it's the principal complaints when people are asked when they're in these situations, what was the worst thing about it? Well, they wouldn't tell us what was going on, and it happens over and over and over. Why can nobody get a handle on, as well as trying to fix the problem, it's really important we tell people what's happening. They never, ever do it, and I can't understand how that can't be addressed.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And just sort of one final bit on that aspect of it about the communications. Again, my friends reported that, after they sort of had their meal and it was relatively quiet outside, they went round to the entrance and the exit where they thought the youngsters were coming out. And what they noticed was that there was a group of parents on the outside who obviously were getting more and more concerned, and kids had left their seats. And although apparently the door staff were being as helpful as they possibly could, there was no criticism of them as such. But of course, once you come out, you're not allowed back in.
Oh yeah.
So what the door staff were doing was they were sort of holding a door open so that youngsters on the inside could shout out to their parents outside, and the parents shout through inside saying, are you sure you're all right? Yeah, we'll be
Who's in charge in these instances? Yeah. As soon as that starts happening, somebody should be relaying this to somebody with some authority to do something. It wouldn't be surprised me if the O2 management didn't actually have access to Bieber or his people. That wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. So they were closeted away somewhere in the bowels of the O2. And the O2's management couldn't get any sense out of them either. But it is unforgivable. Particularly as it shows such a lack of understanding of your audience, their age, and what their needs are. And I think Bieber's trip to the UK has been about as successful as Mitt Romney's was.
Yes,
in terms of the good it's done him. And next time he comes and the kids say, can we go see Justin? You know what the answer's going to be, don't you? I know what mine would be.
Not a chance. But you see, the last point on it is that, you said, you and I would be the same, would be, suing, if you like, to get the money back. But if you're a 13-year-old Bieber fan, that's not going to make the difference for you, is it? Because, the fact that your parents have got their, whatever that chap was saying, well, I think £400 for 3 tickets, that's all well and good, great, you got your money back. But if you're a fan of the fellow, absolutely. that's not going to help, is it? You've lost the chance.
Quite so. It sounds like an absolute disaster, and he needs to do more than tweet some kind of sulky apology. And he also he needs to put a shirt on. If I have to see Justin Bieber's nipples one more time this week, then I'm going to have issues, I can tell you. Put a flipping shirt on, stop moaning, and work harder.
I suspect when he gets back to the States, he's going to tweet, worst tour ever. Yeah. I don't know if you get a chance to check with you, but I did send you a text a couple of days ago because I was watching. I just stumbled across this program by chance on BBC3, and I sent you a text saying, "Well, try and watch this if you can, so we can just talk about it in passing." So I hope that you'll need to confirm this, otherwise we'll need to quickly move on. But did you get a chance to see People Like Us?
Oh yeah, I did. Absolutely. Good.
Good, because it's not our TV review program, but I just stumbled across this a couple of days ago. I think it was Wednesday on BBC Three, and it's a sort of fly on the wall thing yet again, another one of those. But this struck me as particularly interesting. It was in a Manchester suburb called Harper Hay, and apparently 10 years ago it was noted as the most deprived neighbourhood in England, and everything that you would imagine goes with that. Anyway. This was, to me, a little bit out of the ordinary of these sort of fly-on-the-wall things, because there was a sort of definite sort of narrative coming through that I felt the makers of this series were trying to come through, which was of people in Harper Hay trying to do their best to rise above this deprivation. And amongst those we saw... I must say again, I'm terribly sorry if you think that I'm the world's greatest snob, but I just couldn't kind of link with these people at all. I found most of them deeply unlikable. There was a mother and son who worked in the market, and inevitably on these reality things, you know, the boy wanted to be a singer, so we saw him kind of auditioning to a lady that we'll no doubt come back to, Belinda. And it also featured this dance tutor, who wasn't actually a dance tutor, called Kelly, who seemed incredibly feckless. She'd been given this chance to have a job as a dance instructor at a local gymnasium, and then just sort of, because she didn't fancy it very much, she just walked out when the sort of pressure came on. And we also saw the wishy-washy launderette, which seemed to act as a public convenience for passing chaps of the town, and we saw them getting burgled. I just found this a really weird program, so I'm glad that you got a chance to watch it. What did you make of this, People Like Us?
Well, my concern was that it was going to be terribly voyeuristic in a sort of Jeremy Kyle style, that so we were going to be invited to mock, ridicule, and be entertained by the difficulties and the behaviour of the lower classes. Fortunately, it wasn't that. I mean, I thought it was an interesting study of people trying. I thought it was the theme that ran through it for me, that it was the different examples of people disadvantaged for one reason or another trying. Trying to make something of the situations in which they found themselves. I don't agree that they were all unlikable. They were flawed, aren't we all? And they were certainly disadvantaged, which is, you know, almost certainly not their fault. And I was quite drawn to them because they weren't doing what the stereotype would suggest. They weren't perpetual benefits claimants. They weren't lying in bed all day. They weren't bemoaning how unfair everything was. In one way or another, they were all trying. Yes, you're right. The girl Kelly.
Oh, she drove me
well,
mad.
Well, yes, yeah, I know exactly what you mean and why she drove you mad, because she did seem emblematic of a problem I know you've encountered and I've encountered in people, some people of that age who don't understand that committing to something and achieving something requires, you know, hills and valleys and swings and roundabouts, that some bits you're not going to like, and you can't walk away at the bits, you know, as soon as a bit you don't like comes up. But that said, she didn't shrug it off. She didn't say, I'm bored now. She just made a bad choice when she walked out of that rehearsal. And she did come back and she did claim that that she was going to try it again. And I think, you know, that trying thing ran all the way through it. The particular focus that I found really quite hard to watch was the story of the man who had been bored, had been burned as a child, as a child, and how he had acclimatized to his predicament, and how he somehow wanted to ensure that his children didn't suffer any of the difficulties that he'd had through his scars and through his economic circumstances. And I just found this terribly hard to watch. And the man was severely disfigured by what had happened to him. The story of it, how it happened, was just almost unbearable. And again, I was really stirred by his energy and aspiration through the most appalling circumstances. So I found it quite a rewarding experience, and I was really pleased that it didn't, like I say, it wasn't one of these Friday night in inner city, you know, insert name of place here. Here's some
Blackpool like that.
It was completely different from that. It wasn't girls in their 20s lying in the gutters with no knickers on and men fighting and being sick. It was quite distinct from that, and I was pleased to find that. So I did find it quite stirring, quite uplifting, really, in a way. But some of it was very difficult to watch.
You know, I have to say I'm not disadvantaged, and so I hope aware how lucky I am. And I don't know, it probably says more about me than anything else, is the part that you were talking about that was sort of unbearable to watch. I actually could not watch it. Not because of his scars.
No, not at all.
It was because of his story.
Yes, indeed.
And I just couldn't bear it. It was just tearing me in two at the beginning of it. So I literally didn't watch it. I left the room. I kept coming, sort of popping my head around the corner until that bit was finished, because it was just so, I just couldn't cope
it was mentally very difficult to take on board that somebody would have, such bad fortune would have befallen somebody. But that said, he had a partner and he had
three children, I think, or two and a
stepchild. All of whom seemed delightful. They didn't seem in any way badly behaved or delinquent or any of those other things. And he had an opportunity for them to become child models. And the debate about child models is for another day. But this did at least open a window to something of a better life for them. And that's all. That was his absolute priority, was not himself, not particularly improving his lot. As he rightly said, it's very difficult for me to get work. I only have one hand and I look like this. But he would be satisfied if his children achieved something better than he ever could. And that was, it was very upsetting, but also, stimulating, morally boosting to hear him say that, but it was a difficult program.
It was, wasn't it? And again, this, I hope this doesn't sound too flip, but you live up north, you live north of Watford.
Well, I love Watford.
So you become the northern correspondent by default. I'm aware, as I say, that I'm very lucky. I live okay. Do you feel that the circumstances that those people were living in, and of course it was only a snapshot and it wasn't everybody, and I'm sure there are people who are living better lives than these people, but do you think this is in any way typical of life in some northern, particularly parts of major cities or the outskirts of major towns?
I think it's typical of life in many major cities. I don't think the north or south thing has that much to do with it, except that traditionally and factually there is more affluence in the south or the southeast, but that doesn't mean that affluence spreads to everybody. And there was nothing that I saw on people like us that was wildly different from what I used to see living in South London. And indeed parts of South London when I lived there were more deprived than that. So I don't think it's anything to do with the North particularly. I think it is illustrative of a particular strata of British society, regardless of its location.
Okay, well, if you're interested now in watching this series, which is tucked away a bit on BBC Three, that was the fifth of six episodes that we watched earlier in the week. But all of them are available on the BBC iPlayer, so you could, if you wish, catch up with the ongoing lives of the people in Harper Hay, just outside Manchester. Earlier this week, a chap called David Boddy, who is the headmaster of a school in Ashford in Surrey, he wrote a piece in the Daily Telegraph. And I'm just going to actually quote a bit from his piece rather than summarise it, because I think he says it much better than me. It's essentially, going back to children again, this time not enthralled to Justin Bieber, but in a sense, linked to it in the way that children live these days. This is what David Boddy, the headmaster of this school in Ashford, Surrey, says. Every Monday morning at my school, we spend 3 hours trying to get pupils to pay attention in the classroom. This isn't because they are an unruly bunch. They are brilliant, eager young minds with great futures ahead of them. Yet, at a time when they should be at their most rested and interested, they are distracted and inattentive. This is because all weekend they have been plugged into something, watching a screen or playing games on their Xbox, and the last thing they are ready to do is to learn. Now, that's the sort of opening paragraph of this piece. And I spoke, the reason I brought this to our attention, I spoke to a friend of mine a couple of days ago about this, because he works in an office all day, and I thought, well, I wonder if this is peculiar to children, and I'm rather thinking it isn't, because he was telling me that he spends about 8 hours a day looking at a screen. He works in sort of finance and making lots of money for people moving a block on a computer screen to another block, yes, and that makes people
one of those very useful jobs. Yes.
Yes, exactly. But after doing that for 8 hours, he said, well, when he thought about it, he said, well, yes, of course. Then he goes home and looks at his PC or his iPad or his television all evening. Yeah. So it's not just a children thing, is it?
It's not, no. And interesting to see the David Boddy is now a headmaster. I really like that Space Oddity and Diamond Dogs, those tractors.
David Boddy.
But flippancy aside, no, I don't say, I think we heard all this about television, didn't we, in the 50s and 60s, about how it
you'll get square
yeah,
eyes.
It's gonna rock,
if you
see
what
you'll
do, you'll get square
rock
eyes.
Your brain, and, you know, if children just plonked in front of the television will be uncivilized and morally bankrupt and everything. And he's just making the same point all over again. I don't know quite what he expects, that children should be kept away from technology until they were 18. It's impossible. All industries revolve on technology. I was giving a talk a couple of weeks ago to some people in Lincolnshire, and I asked them what they thought would be the consequences of switching off the internet. If the internet was switched off tomorrow, what were the consequences? And they said the obvious things, like, you know, you couldn't check your emails, you couldn't use social media and everything. But what they didn't realize was that all the supermarkets would close, all the banks would stop working, all the lights would go out, you know, because it is all driven by internet-based technology. So I don't know what this headmaster expects. Also, I don't know how he can be so sure that his children's lack of concentration is down to the fact that they've been using technology all weekend. How does he know that? He hasn't indulged in any scientific study. And he's not alone, but he is a minority voice amongst teachers in complaining about this. So I think he's just being very Luddite and not suggesting an alternative. And you know, Monday morning, it's class full of young teenagers. Are they, I mean, what does he expect? You know, they've just had the weekend. When we had the weekend, when we were at school, we were riding bikes, we were playing with Action Men, or I was certainly, we were watching Starsky and Hutch, we were sitting in each other's lofts and stuff. And when come Monday morning came, we were still in that mindset. It was the teachers rolled slowly drain that adrenaline out of us and start teaching us something desperately dull like algebra. So
okay, but there's a really important point you make there, which I think does, I think, give Mr. Boddy ground control to David Boddy. There's some credibility, because you're saying when you were young, you were out on your bike and you were in your friend's lofts and mucking about and so on. Now, what a part of this piece, Mr. Boddy says that children seem to think they've got friends if they're listed on Facebook. And if you think your, he says, if you think your friends are online, you're missing the human dynamic of a real relationship. You can't see facial expressions, can't hear the tone of voice. All you're dealing with is digital messages, which he actually says are usually meaningless and never meaningful, which I would take up with him there. He says, I fear our young people are losing their ability to form relationships and strike up conversations. But you see, well, there's maybe something to that. You see, I engage with a lot of people on Twitter, for example, yeah. and the majority of them I've never met. Sure. But I kind of think of them as friends.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not entirely sure I want to meet them all. I don't mean that as an offensive thing, but, you know, it works the way it is. But does that mean that, you know, I'm missing out on what, you know, you were describing as that interaction you had when you were young and you were mucking about in the real lifetime?
No, not at all, because Mr. Body, ashes to ashes, fun to fun. Mr. Body seems to be under the impression that this is the only way that young people interact with each other. But we've just spoken about groups of young people congregating outside of an evening, with little to do, it would seem, but that's hardly their fault. And so it's just one of the ways young people interact with each other. People I knew when I was a kid had pen pals, but nobody ever said, you shouldn't write to somebody in Zambezi and exchange information, because that's not a physical relationship. You're never going to meet them. You're never going to interact through the conversation. It was just another way of having another friend somewhere else. Obviously, that has, you know, expanded exponentially to a sort of space odyssey proportion. You know, it was, we're living in the science fiction future that we read about in comics as kids, but so be it. But kids still want to knock about together. You know, so if that was the case, if kids didn't want to congregate, then Justin Bieber could have gone on 10 hours late. It wouldn't matter, because nobody would have been there. They'd have all been Facebooking each other. It's just not the case, and I don't know what he suggests we do about it.
If you want to see that piece, it's up online at the Telegraph's website. If you just Google to find it, which I tested earlier, Telegraph National Attention Deficit Disorder, okay. As he's calling it, you'll find that piece.
And David Body has a new album out for the next day. Remains to be seen whether he'll be touring, but he's not doing interviews.
No, too busy at school. continuing looking at the way we live, earlier this week, I met a friend for lunch, which is no great strange
Playing death metal.
Here's the thing. He suggested to me that we go to this local pub in Marlow, and we just noticed that there was a sign outside saying half price food on Mondays. Can you believe it? Believe our luck. Anyway, here's the story. I ordered a pie, chips and peas. Mm-hmm. And our food arrived about 5 minutes after we ordered it, which suggested to me the heavy use of the microwave.
That's interesting. I went for a Sunday lunch with my mother a couple of Sundays ago, and there was a big board outside the pub we went to that said, our Sunday lunch doesn't go ping.
Oh,
but I didn't understand
good.
What it meant.
The microwave,
my mum
of course.
My mum said, well, what does that mean? And I said, Mother, I haven't the faintest idea. What are they talking about? So we asked, and that's what they meant, that it doesn't come out of a microwave, yeah.
Well, this clearly must have done, which also made me think about the quality of the food. It was okay, I'm still here. But anyway, the total bill, two lunches. Now, I know you're going to say, you know, this is like outrageous beyond Watford, but for the Marlow in Buckinghamshire, total bill, two lunches, two soft drinks, £11.41 and the food delivered within 5 minutes, as I say. So I'm wondering how any business can make a profit on that margin. Because it was half price Monday.
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
The my pie, chips and peas, with quite nice gravy and a little jug, by the way.
Yeah.
I think it worked out at £4 or £3, something 83, either £3.83 or £4.83. So I'm wondering how any business can make a profit on that margin. So I did a little bit of research, and I found this report about pubs in decline on the BBC. And this report says that pubs closing at the rate of 18 per week across the UK. And many of these pubs are blaming the smoking ban, which I can't see how that would actually mean fewer people go. I mean, make more people go anyway. How you can get cut price drinking supermarkets. So, Magnus, can you go and save the Great British Pub, or is their day come? Is it all over?
I think it possibly is. I can't save them. I don't drink, but I do smoke, which is totally the wrong way round for the use of a pub these days. And the only time I would go to a pub is to eat. And use it as a restaurant, as you did. But I think one of the problems is the price of drinks over the bar is in a time of austerity, it's fairly prohibitive. I've seen people go up to the bar while I've been eating and get, I don't know, four drinks and pay, you know, the best part of £20. I mean, that is fairly unsustainable, I would have thought, as a leisure activity. A lot of that is in tax, but also the on-costs. So the cost of electricity is particularly high, and a pub has to pay all its bills. And we must really shine a heated spotlight on the pub co's, which are these huge conglomerates that lease pubs out to people, who are striking the most punitive deals with their tenants, whereby it's almost the tenants have signed a contract where they cannot possibly make money. And
what are they called, Magnus? Pub co's.
Yeah, short for public house companies, I suppose.
Oh,
I won't name any for fear of attracting legal attention, but there is no doubt that the contracts that these pub co's are holding their licensees to are just ridiculously greedy, and people are just turning the keys in. They're just saying, I might as well go on benefits. I might as well go back to what I was doing before I took a chance on this, plumbing or whatever, because I can't make money under your contract. Of course, you have to buy all your booze from the pub co and pay various other bills for facilities to the pub co. And they've got you by the short and curlies, and they are, I would suggest, stripping out any wealth that there might still be in the pub industry in order to fill their own pockets. So I think the pub co's have got a lot to answer for these 18 pubs a week closing. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realise that. It's sort of like a cartel of where you're sort of forced to buy.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of the sort of slum landlords of the 60s, you know, of charging a ridiculous amount of money for something fairly modest getting rich off the proceeds.
When I was very, very, very young, a very, very long time ago, that I suspect that this may have something to do with it, that the way we live has changed. Back then, let's say early 60s, there were only two television channels and the radio. Obviously, no internet or any other distractions. And I think it was the way people lived, is that they would see going to the pub as a bit of an escape from that sort of way of life, and it was somewhere to meet people. People didn't generally have such sort of well-appointed homes as they do now. But I think that way of living is almost completely gone. I don't know anybody now who thinks, I'm going to pop down the pub for a pint of beer. That it's just not done, especially men on their own. And that, I think, was what kept many of these, if you like, pubs on the corner of a street, rather than places that I would go to, which is, as you rightly said, to get a meal hopefully with better facilities. Yeah. But those pubs on the corner on two sort of side streets, I don't think anymore. That generation has died out, where they may go and say, oh, I'm popping down the pub for a pint, see you in an hour.
Yes, I would totally agree with that. I think that pattern of behaviour has been broken almost without fail. Once I was bathed and on my way to bed, and the telly was winding down, my dad without fail, would walk down the road, and he would have a pint at the local pub. He'd smoke his pipe, he'd have a pint, and he'd come back, what, you know, an hour and a half later.
Yes.
And that's sort of what the working gentleman did, really. It was absolutely in keeping with a pattern of behaviour, and he would do that as a matter of course, just in the same way that he'd brush his teeth and... his other daily
have a shave
pounds.
In the morning.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't think people do that. I think people are forced to work much later. I think that is somehow frowned upon as well. I think if a man goes to the pub every night, people there's some sort of question mark over this. My father was in no way negligent. He was a lovely man and a great dad. And this was just his wind down. While he was doing that, my mum would be getting ready for bed, probably reading a book and having a silk cut. That's what they did in the 70s. And you're right. I don't think anybody really has that sort of reflex behaviour anymore.
There's all these campaigns, to save the British pub and everything. But I don't mean to be too negative about this, but if something's had its day and it's gone, we don't have music halls anymore, and we don't throw a particularly religious group to the lions in the Colosseum in Rome anymore. Life moves on, and it could be the same, we say, for pubs as well. It's one of those things of our heritage that's going, but it's part of the natural order of things. It's gone.
Yeah, I think so. But I just think, to an extent, if it's the natural way of things that leisure activities move on, then I guess fair enough. But I think there's also something more pernicious tied up in it, which is the economics of the whole thing.
As you mentioned. Okay, now for our television review this week, my goodness me, we watched on BBC Three, it's obviously BBC Three week for us, on Wednesday, the first in a new series, Bluestone 42. My goodness, where to start? Well, it opened with something, I suppose, a cliched lineup, a brash American, polite Brits, a woman soldier determined to show that she's the equal of any chap. There was a male lead, Oliver Chris. He appears to have been chosen for his physical likeness to Prince William. The American bloke took his helmet off and he got shot. For me, it was a bit like MASH. Without the actors, the script, the staging. Bluestone 42, Magnus.
Yeah. I thought the setup was quite promising. The idea of a comedy set in a desert war zone. I assume we're in Afghanistan. With this, I thought, had some potential. And in the hands of maybe Armando Iannucci or Chris Morris, this might have been, very razor-edged and quite satirical and made some rather important points about warfare using humour. One thinks of the Chris Morris film Four Lions and the take on domestic terrorism that portrays. I've no problem with the setup at all, and I certainly don't jump on board with some of the complainees who say you can't make humour out of war. So just two words: they're Dad's Army. So, however, that is where the comparison with Dad's Army ends, because, and we've mentioned this before, and I hate to go on about it again. I mean, I'd said it in last week's podcast, so I do apologise for it. But here's the problem with a lot of modern comedy. And it's a very glib observation, but it's nonetheless true. It's not funny. If you're making a comedy show, you've got to, at the table read, when you see the rushes, when you watch the rehearsals on location, you've got to constantly ask yourself, is this funny? And I can't believe that anybody involved in the production of Bluestone 42 could, at any point in the production, put their hand on their heart and say, yeah, this is really funny. because they would be fooling themselves. By any standard, this was not very funny. And I don't know if they think, well, it's for a teenage audience, so we don't have to try so hard, or there are no writers out there who, at least who have been brought to the attention of the BBC, are able to write scripts that are funny, or just the standard of humour has dropped so low that will do. But this, I can't believe anybody sat rocking with laughter at this. And then you get a sort of rather paltry excuse of, oh yeah, but it's not supposed to be laugh out loud funny. But I don't buy that. It's a comedy. And you're not telling me that if you were getting reports that people were doing themselves a mischief because of the gales of laughter emanating from their bodies, that you would say, oh dear, it's gone horribly wrong. You wouldn't. You'd be quite pleased at that. So it is supposed to be laugh out of funny because it is a comedy, but it just isn't. And you know, there's some decent people in it. There's minor celebrity Tony Gardner.
Who, of course, I worked with last year.
Yeah, and of course, I upset by calling him, yes, a minor celebrity in a tweet. Yes. And I like Tony Gardner. In one of the most recent comedies that was actually funny, Lead Balloon, he was delicious as Michael in Lead Balloon. And I loved Lead Balloon, and that was laugh out loud funny. Why can we not manage that? And if we can't, if we have a script, if we have a production that doesn't meet that sort of minimum standard of being funny, then, you know, the BBC and other production companies should not be afraid to say, no, this has got to go back and this has got to be made funnier. It seems that stuff is reaching the screen which just doesn't meet the required standard of humour.
No. Awkward for me when I review something and somebody I know is in it, but that's not going to hold me back. I just my conscience wouldn't allow me to say this is any good. I mean, it was beautifully crisp, clearly filmed. Yes. It was very well filmed, but very slowly paced, and everybody was performing like they were cartoon characters, but not in a good way, in a kind of cliched way. It was filmed. It looked like it was Andalusia, but it was actually filmed in South Africa. And you know you're in trouble with a programme. If you're the programme maker, you know you're in trouble when the Department of Trade and Industry of South Africa insists that they can put up a disclaimer in the credits that says that, you know, they're disassociating themselves from the show, which was the most extraordinary thing. It said, you know, the Department of Trade and Industry of South Africa, you know, something like, you know, wants to point out that this program bears no relation to blah, 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 and, you know, the content is not the responsibility of the DTI in South Africa. So I thought, well, they got their disclaimer in quickly. Yeah. It was, for me, it was the longest 30 minutes of the week. I just sort of dire. I watched it. I recorded it. I think I was watching football, so I recorded it. And when you finish recording on Virgin Media, which I've got, it says, "We hope you enjoyed your viewing. Are you sure you want to delete Bluestone 42? And I was clicking that yellow button like there was no tomorrow. Yes, I do.
Yeah, I mean, the colonel who dies right at the very beginning that you mentioned, from takes his helmet off and is immediately shot in the head, was, I couldn't help noticing, was Mike McShane, who is a great Canadian, a great in several senses of the word, great Canadian comedian who was a regular on Have I Got News For You? No, sorry, Whose Line Is It Anyway? In the 80s and early 90s, and is a terrific comedy actor. Being shot in the head was a blessing to him.
It was, yes.
Or he had to take
one of
those
early people at the Comedy Store.
And he's great. He's great. There were people in it who genuinely great. And it was not a cheap production. Not only did they have cast and crew out in South Africa, but we had proper explosions, proper military equipment and trucks and tanks and goodness. But, you know, no script of any description.
No, absolutely. And this was on BBC Three. It's on iPlayer if you want to see it. It was written by Richard Hurst and James Carey, directed by Ian B. MacDonald for BBC Productions. It won't be troubling my screen again, nor yours.
No, make it funny. Make it funny.
Yeah, make it funny.
It's simple as that.
Oh, look, it's time for the pretend iPod, which is how we close our podcasts, where we each pick a tune C-H-O-O-N. We pick a tune that will go onto the Pretend iPod, which new listeners you can find on the Rocking Vicar website, and it's also featured under in Spotify under the name of my colleague here, Magna Shaw. I imagine that most people first came across Chrissie Hynde when her band first appeared on Top of the Pops. But my memories go back to the early part of the 70s, when she emerged on my radar anyway as the rather loud and shrieky girlfriend of Nick Kent from the NME. And I at the time, I was very young, 17, 18, and I both looked up to Nick Kent, but also thought he was a bit of a twerp, as his brain never quite appeared to be completely in touch with the rest of his body. But we literally looked up to Nick Kent, as he is something of a beanpole, and we called him the giraffe because he always seemed to be standing in front of us at gigs on the London pub circuit, which was extremely irritating. But no matter what you sort of moved to, 2 minutes later, Nick Kent would be standing in front of you. He was forever having loud rows with his girlfriend, then known as Chris Hynde. Everybody said, oh, this is my girlfriend, Chris. He was always having rows with her, and they were often to be found outside these pubs. Nick Kent slumped against a wall or hanging over a bin or something, and Chris Hynde screaming at him with all of her Ohio might. So, it was quite a surprise about 5 years later to see from this wreckage Chrissie Hynde and the Pretenders emerge into one of the most successful pop acts of the 1980s. And the classic lineup of the Pretenders only existed for a short time, mainly for the rather sort of no way back reason that two of the four members died, which would account for it. Bass player Pete Farndon and that excellent guitarist James Honeyman Scott, they both left this earth due to heroin and cocaine overdoses, respectively. So on that cheery note, my selection comes from the classic grouping anyway, on Pretenders 2, not surprisingly their second album, and it contains some great tracks, Message of Love, I Go to Sleep, and my pick for this week, Talk of the Town. Such a drag to want something sometimes, one thing leads to another, I know, was a time wanted you for mine, nobody knew. You arrive like a day and pass like a cloud. Superb lyrics that, through the song, also take you through a sort of forlorn love affair. Which, you know, having just said what I said about Chrissie Hynde, you may be able to draw some allusion or collusion there. A difficult song to play on guitar, with arpeggios all over the place, but with those emotional minor chords to pull at your heart. Written by Chrissie Hynde, recorded at Wessex Studios in 1981, reaching nowhere in the Billboard Hot 100, but number 8 in the UK Top 40. 3 minutes, 13 seconds, The Pretenders, it's the talk of the town.
Yeah, the Pretenders are sort of one of those eternal bands, aren't they? However the fashions and trends move in music, you can always come back to the Pretenders and find that the quality is still there. And they're not sort of locked into the 80s or the 90s where they had their most of their success. You go back and listen to, I don't know, some of their contemporaries, maybe Visage, say, and you can enjoy it, but it's very much plonked in that 80s. In the decade of the 80s, but the Pretenders just sort of seem eternal, don't they? Perhaps that's because they rather sensibly sort of took all their inspiration from classic rock and roll, which does seem to sustain. But Chrissie Hynde is a superb songwriter, and that initial lineup, Honeyman Scott and Martin Chambers and Chrissie Hynde, really, really could just knock out sterling hit after sterling hit, couldn't they? Back on the Chain Gang, every time I hear it, you know, I get little tingles. That's such a good track, and so is Talk of the Town. which you've picked, and I guess you could have picked, you know, any two dozen tracks from that.
It's funny you say that, because yes, I did nearly pick I Go to Sleep, and then I looked at a couple of others, but then I just love the jangly guitar from Honey and Scott here. I think I totally agree with you, but I would say Chrissy Hynde probably punched me in the face for saying this, but I think they are the total definition of a singles band. I don't think I could listen to their greatest hits, but I don't think I could, you know, think, oh, I'd like to listen to a Pretenders album.
No, quite.
They're a single.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Chrissy Hynde would probably punch you in the face for no other reason than that's her proclivity.
Yes.
Yeah, she's quite fond of that. She's a tricky character and often quite troubled about various things. And the extraordinary thing about Chrissy Hynde that springs to mind is that I remember reading that when she was a teenage girl in Ohio, was it Akron? Did she come from Akron?
Yeah, Akron, Ohio.
That her absolute hero that she doted on and had pictures of, and, you know, the way teenage girls do, and teenage lads for that matter, was Ray Davies of the Kinks. She was absolutely obsessed with him. Of course, how could she have known that she would come over to the UK and marry him? That must be extraordinary. Yeah. That must be an extraordinary experience. Clearly that didn't last. And she also married Jim Kerr of the Simple Minds, didn't she? And that didn't last either.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Pretenders core. Yes, yeah, so you could just go away now and spend the rest of the afternoon listening to Pretenders singles, couldn't you? They're really that good. Yeah, great pick.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, I thought it was about time we added a slice of Madonna to the Pretend iPod. I don't know why we've never gone there before, but let's put that right. However, the question is, and I guess this is true of the Pretenders as well, what do you pick? I mean, there is so much. Okay, yeah, she's gone off the boil a bit recently, but it would be a foolish man who didn't recognise the pop glory of the Madonna back catalogue. So I was a hair's breadth from choosing the magnificent Vogue, which is still an outstanding record, and I guess a record that all but defines pop in the 1990s. It's really, I think, that good. But then I remembered the song that Madonna did from one of her breathtakingly accomplished acting gigs. But actually, to be fair, the movie A League of Their Own wasn't half bad. Good supporting cast there, Rosie O'Donnell and Tom Hanks really doing the heavy lifting, and Madonna buzzing around in the background. It came out in 1991, the movie, and as I say, it wasn't half bad. And the title theme, and of course the marketing people would have thought, well, if we're going to have Madonna in this thing, we're going to get her to do a song for it, and well, why wouldn't you? But often when a star does a song for a movie, it's a bit throwaway. Well, you think of something like the Hold Me, Kill Me, Kiss Me, Thrill Me, or whatever you two did for the Batman movie. Not one of their best efforts. This was an exception to that rule. She did a song called This Used to Be My Playground, and it's utterly, utterly wonderful. Indeed, I'd stick my neck out and say it is probably one of her best singles, certainly in the Madonna top three for me. But I can't help thinking, for some reason, Madonna doesn't agree with me on this. So I could get the impression I'm defending Madonna's own song back to her, because she's never performed it in concert. It doesn't even appear on her greatest hits, any of her greatest hits compilations, which we've had over the years. It is on a Madonna compilation called Something to Remember, which I don't know if it's still available, but it's her slow numbers compiled. That's what I've got it on anyway. But that's about it. That's really the best source for this song. But that's such a shame, because it's an absolutely beautiful expression of regret and nostalgia for a more innocent age, more innocent times. Why do they always say, don't look back, she wonders. I love that lyric. It's fantastic. Rather than saying, I'm looking back and I'm a bit sad, it's that idea that people want to stop her from looking back, that it's that some people say it's a bad thing to look back, and it's the where she's drawing her joy from is looking back at happier times. It's a really mature and thoughtful lyric, and actually genuinely written by Madonna, with a little help from Shep Pettibone, I have to say, but it is a Madonna lyric, and that's a real tribute to her as a songwriter. We don't really think of her as a songwriter, but in this instance she manages to be honest and wistful and genuinely moving, and it's wonderfully performed as well. So quite why Madonna keeps this so well hidden is a mystery to me. Perhaps somebody out there knows why Madonna keeps this song so heavily under wraps, but all I can do is give it a sliver of exposure now and have it as my pick for the pretend iPod. It's Madonna, and This Used to Be My Playground.
Ah, it's a great choice. I didn't realise until you told us there that she, you know, doesn't perform it, because I would agree with you. I'd put it in the top three. I'd have Papa Don't Preach and This Used to Be My Playground certainly up there. And it was a huge hit across the world. It was the number one in America, only number three here. But for me, it was a sort of bounce back, because Vogue was great, but in the 90s, she kind of lost her way a little bit. I think a single or two before, it was that dreadful Hanky Panky single, which is just awful.
Yes, which was, but this was written for the Dick Tracy movie, which just shows that stars often don't give the full attention when they're doing a song for a movie, but this wasn't the case here.
No, it's lovely, and as you say, the lyrics are simple, but life is short, and before you know, you're feeling old, and your heart is breaking. Don't hold on to the past. Well, that's too much to ask.
Absolutely.
So, it's like you say, it's kind of hitting back against people saying, you know, don't look backwards. You know, look back if you want to.
Which I think is quite. I can't think of a song that quite captures that sentiment. Any other song that quite captures that, and that's why it's just. It's always for me the sound of Madonna being grown up, and I think one of her failings, not that she has many, but one of her failings is that she always tries to be the naughty little girl. And when she isn't, you get this, and it's a very grown-up lyric and a very grown-up performance. And I think that's why I like it so much.
Well, you can hear a little snippet of This Used to Be My Playground and Talk of the Town at the end of the podcast, but you can hear them in full on the Rocking Vickers Pretend iPod and on Magnus Shaw's Spotify playlist.
Yes, you can indeed. And with those two smashing records, we shall draw a veil over this week's podcast. And we thank Mr. DeComp for being our constant companion on the podcasts. What a delight it is, and we'll see you again next time we do it. And we should also thank you, wherever you're listening, for doing so, because otherwise we'd be talking to ourselves. And I should also just say hi to everybody who listens on Spreaker, because just having a peep at the statistics on Spreaker, we have some very, very dedicated and numerous listeners on Spreaker. So hello if you're listening on Spreaker, and indeed,
hello.
Goodbye, because we're off now, and we'll see you in 7 days. Bye-bye.
Such a drag to want something so intense. One thing leads to another, I know. Was a time I wanted you for mine. Nobody knew. Like a cloud, I made a wish, I said it out loud, out loud in a crowd. Everybody heard, 'twas the talk of the town. It's not my place to know what you feel. I'd like to know, but why should I? Who are you there? Who are you now? Well, common labor by night, Friday highbrow. Back in my room, I wonder that I sit on the bed, look at the sky. Up in the sky, how do you bathe? Like the talk of the town.
This used to be my childhood dream.
that's too much to ask.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shore media production.